got a full tank of gas, half a pack of cigarettes, it's dark, and we're wearing sunglasses.
Hit it.
I got a bad feeling about this.
You see, we're on a mission from God.
Why, oh why, didn't I take the blue pill?
Help me, Obi-Wan Kenobi. You're my only hope.
You want answers!
I want the truth! You can't handle the truth!
Tackling life's most important questions. This is the Don Johnson Show.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to another edition of the Don Johnson Show. My name is Don. Great to have you along. Broadcasting from high atop the Tower of Hope here on the campus of Christ Cathedral in Orange County, California, here on the Immaculate Heart Radio Network. Coming up at the bottom of the hour, we have a story about scientists who claim to be able to zap people's brains with magnets and cure their belief in God. So that's a fun story. We'll talk a little bit about that. Also in the second half of the hour, we've got some miracle stories. One of the things I noticed as I was filming the documentary Convinced is how often a miracle story played a big part in people's conversion. And I want to share a few miracle stories on the show today and discuss how we might better use them in evangelization. I think a lot of people have good miracle stories in their lives, but they are hesitant to use them and share them with others. So I want to talk a little bit about that this morning. First, though, we have a very special guest. As you may know, here on the show, we like to celebrate converts. We like to celebrate people who are involved in evangelization and people who are having an effect in the culture, reaching out into an increasingly secular culture. And this guy checks the box on all of those. Brandon Vaught is an author, a blogger, a speaker. He's the content director for Bishop Robert Barron's Word on Fire Ministries. His work has been featured by several media outlets, including NPR, Fox News, CBS, EWTN, Vatican Radio, and Christianity Today. He's a regular on shows like this and has been named one of the top 30 Catholics under 30 and one of the top 24 Catholics to follow on Twitter. His books include Saints and Social Justice, Catholicism, The New Evangelization, and The Church and New Media. Brandon Vaught, welcome to the Don Johnson Show.
Hey, Don. So great to be here.
Brandon, we were hoping to have you out here for the big premiere a couple of weeks ago. You didn't quite make it, but I got to tell you that everybody loved your appearance in the movie.
You have no idea how many people I paid to come there and say nice things about the film. So I'm glad to hear that it paid off.
Hey, for those of you who don't know your conversion story, was there one or two big hurdles that you had to overcome that you just struggled with in regards to Catholicism? And I just, you know, I can't buy this, or you really had to dig deep into any particular subjects?
Sure. Yeah. There was a couple big sea changes in the way I had to think. One of them was I had just imbibed the idea of sola scriptura, a Bible alone, that the Bible is the ultimate authority for Christians. I'd sort of just absorbed that unquestionably as a Protestant. And so when I first discovered that the Catholic Church also embraced sacred tradition as a way of knowing God's revelation, it was sort of eye-opening and jarring. And then also the Eucharist. The Eucharist, for me, was very pivotal. And then it wasn't just a symbolic gesture or ceremony. That, to me, was sort of the deciding factor. I got to a point where I said, either the Catholics are right and Jesus is present, and in that case, I have to become Catholic. What else can I do? I want to be as close to the Lord as possible. Or, as Scott Hahn came to the same conclusion, this is the greatest idolatry man could devise, pretending that a piece of bread is really the divine savior. So I read several books. I got deep into the church fathers, had many conversations with Catholics about this issue. And once I became convinced that the Catholics were right, that John chapter 6, the church fathers, the great tradition, universally attest to this belief that Jesus is present in the Eucharist, then I knew that everything else would fall into place after that, because I wanted the Lord and he was present through the sacrament.
Right. Now, you have written, Brandon, a couple of books about the saints. They seem to have played a pretty big role in your life. Tell me about that. I know that as an evangelical, the saints are sort of, I don't know, mysterious and weird, and what are those Catholics doing with all the saints? But you seem to have really found strength there.
I did. Yeah, one of the mentors who kind of shepherded me along my conversion process shrewdly recommended very early on, when I first was exploring the Catholic Church, to, instead of focusing on doctrines, focus on the saints, because his belief was that the saints are the ideal examples of the Catholic life. I think most of us would agree that the saints live out, maybe not perfectly, but in an imitable way, the teachings of Christ and his church. So he said, if you want to sort of get the Catholic thing, look at the saints, look at how they live, look at what they wrote, look at how they prayed. So he gave me several saints biographies and saints books, and they've always had a tremendous influence on me. You know, it's one thing to dwell in the abstract intellectual world of philosophy and theology and doctrine and dogma, but the saints add flesh to that skeleton, and I think they're a much more vivid, attractive example for people outside the church and even people within it. So I have devoted a lot of my work to using the saints as images or maybe as gateways to draw people into the Catholic faith. You mentioned one of my most recent books called Saints and Social Justice. I wanted to represent Catholic social teaching, which many people think of as the most abstract, convoluted, complex set of teachings within the church. Many people find it hard to define or articulate. I wanted to take these brilliant teachings and add color and life and verve to them by looking at them through the lives of the saints, answering the question, which saints best lived out the church's teachings and how can we follow their example? So I think that's a good approach, especially for skeptics and Protestants and non-Catholics of every stripe. Instead of focusing on what the church teaches, put forward the example of the saints who lived out those teachings very winsomely.
Yeah, I think you're really right on the money there, that it is the people that exemplify what the church teaches that really have the impact in the culture. I think even, you know, this is why I made a movie, for instance, is I would actually more prefer to write a book and tell you all the teachings and give you the doctrine. But when you see the people sort of, and this is the main response that I've had actually from the film, people come up to me and say, you could just feel the joy and the happiness and the new life that the folks in your film found in Jesus and in the church. You can just feel that almost coming through, and it's just such an example. And I think that your focus on the saints and showing those people to the world is really just a tremendous approach here and will have a great impact. Have you gotten a good response from your books and people getting more into these, you know, old dead people that, you know, lived long ago and why should we care? I mean, have people really gotten into that?
Yeah, I hope so. I've heard from lots of people, so there's a lot of good anecdotal evidence that it's been helping a lot of people. I've been most pleasantly surprised to learn that, especially that book, Saints and Social Justice, has been adopted by lots of high school and college classes, because most high schools, Catholic high schools, are obligated to teach at least one semester on social justice or Catholic social teaching. And quite frankly, most of the resources are dubious at best.
Right.
Many of them, I think, miss the core of the Catholic social teaching tradition. But there's just not a lot of good textbooks or books or resources out there for teachers, so they're kind of left grasping in this area. What do I do? What do I teach? So I think this book was like a welcome alternative where they could take these teachings, and especially because they're framed through stories, the stories of the saints, they're much more accessible to students than just a dry abstract textbook. So that's one thing that I've been pleasantly surprised to see. A lot of high schoolers, college students, young adults have used this book as a gateway to the church's social teaching.
Right. Now, you talked about how a lot of our understanding in the culture of the Catholic social justice teaching, we have misconceptions about it. Are there one or two main misconceptions that you think people have that you tried to sort of correct or bring to light with your book about the nature of social justice and what the Catholic Church actually teaches?
Sure. I think the biggest problem in general is that Catholic social teaching is too often viewed through political lenses, whether it be in America or in other countries. The problem with that is that Catholic social teaching doesn't fit neatly within a liberal or conservative or left or right grid. It's just its own thing. It's Catholic. It doesn't fit neatly into our political categories. I think more specifically, one of the greatest problems that I tried to solve with this book is the bifurcation between the so-called social justice issues. So things like caring for the poor, championing peace, care for the environment, these sorts of things, And on the other hand, the life and dignity issues, so things like countering abortion or contraception, fighting against euthanasia and the death penalty. Unfortunately, in the church, those two groups are typically distinct and sometimes even at odds with each other. Some people think that if you emphasize pro-life issues, such as fighting against abortion, that by necessity, you must not care that much about the poor, the vulnerable, the environment, the disenfranchised. And just the opposite is true. Some people think that if you worry too much about feeding the hungry or giving homes to the homeless or clothes to the naked, that you, by necessity, neglect focusing on these pro-life issues. So what I try to do in the book is show that that bifurcation is one that just doesn't exist in Catholic social teaching, that all of these teachings are intertwined and that the same principles that undergird supporting life are the same principles that undergird caring for the poor, the vulnerable, and the environment. And so each of the figures I highlight in the book are what I would call complete Catholics. They not only champion the life and dignity of the human person, but they're also pro-social justice in all these other ways. So if I can only accomplish that, if this book only helps to close that divide between these two subgroups of Catholicism, then I think it'll be a success.
We are talking to Brandon Vaught. You can find out more about him at brandonvaught.com. And the book he was just discussing is Saints and Social Justice, A Guide to Changing the World. I highly recommend it. And I totally agree with you, Brandon, that that's one thing I found in becoming a Catholic is I no longer had to have those strong bifurcations. And it sort of transcended politics in many ways. We will have more with Brandon right after this break. You are listening to the Don Johnson Radio Show on Immaculate Heart Radio. We'll be right back. Hey everybody, welcome back to the Don Johnson Show. My name is Don, broadcasting from high atop the Tower of Hope here at Christ Cathedral Campus in Orange County, California. It is very nice to have you along on the Immaculate Heart Radio Network today. I'm here with a very special guest. Brandon Vaught is a young convert to the faith. He wrote the Guide to Catholicism, that amazing DVD series that I hope you have all seen. If not, please go check it out. Brandon Vaught, welcome back to the Don Johnson Show.
Thank you, Don. It's great to be here.
Now, one thing that I'm particularly interested in, you've got all these endeavors going on, but one thing I really enjoy about your work is a website called strangenotions.com. And, hey, it's a strange name. Why don't we just start with, what's that all about, strangenotions.com?
Great. I'm glad that you have confusion about the name because it's exactly what we were shooting for. We wanted a name that would cause people to curiously ask, what is that? The name comes from the 17th chapter of Acts, where we read about St. Paul's journey to Athens, Greece, and he visits the Areopagus, which is also called Mars Hill. And the scriptures tell us that St. Paul goes to this hub of the ancient intellectual world, and he's invited to share this strange, surprising message of Jesus risen from the dead with a group of philosophers who sit on the Areopagus, on this hill. And the Bible say all day they just sit around and discuss new things, which to me always sounded a lot like the internet, just a bunch of people discussing new things.
Right.
All they did. So Paul walks up and he very shrewdly uses their own poets, their own philosophers, their own religious imagery to weave this message of Jesus risen from the dead. And despite his great rhetorical efforts, he's mostly met with disdain. Some people say, get him out of here. We don't want to hear any more about this. But some of his listeners said, you bring some strange notions to our ears, and we want to hear more. Can you come back tomorrow and tell us more? And so he did and was able to make a handful of converts. So that was kind of the first meeting between a Christian evangelist and an atheist crowd, a group of pagan intellectuals. So we wanted to mimic that online. Anybody who goes to any website that deals with Catholic apologetics or atheist and agnostic apologetics knows that most of them are extremely virulent and angry and full of heated rhetoric. They're not places that you want to spend too long into. So we wanted to create an oasis online where Catholics and atheists could come to discuss the big questions of life in a charitable, respectable forum. So we created this site with over 30 different contributors, so people like Bishop Robert Barron and Dr. Peter Kraft and Father Robert Spitzer, some of the smartest thinkers in the Catholic world today, who contribute articles and videos and different posts. We have three new posts a week, but then the real action happens in the comment boxes, where thousands and thousands of Catholics and atheists have visited over the last couple of years to chat about these big questions and really get at the heart of the truth. So we've been really pleased with how it's taken off over the last couple of years. We've had over 2 million visitors who have read at least something on the site, and couldn't be more pleased with the way that it's reshaped the Catholic atheist dialogue.
Yeah, I as well. I applaud it. It fits very well in what we try to do here at the Don Johnson Show and Don Johnson Ministries. It's very much about reaching out into a culture of unbelief. And one thing we've talked about before, Brandon, is that you mentioned that Catholic apologetics is often a little bit angry and not a very comfortable place as a seeker or skeptic to join into. Also, a lot of times it's focused on Protestants, but you made a point that really today's divide you don't think is so much Protestant Catholic as it is secular Christian. Do you want to expand on that a little bit?
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right, Don. You've said that several times, and I wholly agree with it, that I think over the last 10 to 20 years, most Catholic apologetics has been focused on helping Protestants, or specifically evangelical and fundamentalist Protestants, come into the Catholic Church. And that was desperately needed. It helped a ton of people. I'm one example. You and all the people featured in Convinced are many other examples. But I think today the great battle is against secularism, which is just a complete rejection of God and religious things. I find that many of my peers who are in their 20s and 30s, they aren't debating over which Christian tradition is correct. For most of them, God and church aren't even on the radar. So the big challenge today is to get them thinking about these big questions of life, to help them to grasp that the question of God is really the central question of their whole existence, that how you answer the God question is going to shape every other area of your life. And first establishing those bare bones truths that God exists, that God is love, that Jesus is God, that Jesus was raised from the dead. Even before we get into what church did Jesus establish, we first need to get all those preliminary questions on the table. That's kind of what we try to do at Strange Notions.
Yeah, and you do an excellent job of it. Are there certain posts, certain topics that rise to the top or are the most popular? What have you found as you've watched the discussion take place there?
Sure, I'll mention a few of them. We just put together a resource. Anybody going to strangenotions.com for the first time, you can download a free ebook which has our top 10 posts, so the top 10 posts that have generated the most traffic. We have over 500 posts, so we kind of pulled out the top 10 so people can get that quick and easy. By far the most popular post is one that's linked to from the homepage and from every page on our website, which is by Dr. Peter Kraft, and it's called 20 Arguments for the Existence of God, or 20 Arguments for God's Existence. And he very pithily summarizes 20 of the most common and popular classical arguments for God. So these include Thomas Aquinas's 5 proofs. They include C.S. Lewis's argument from desire. They include arguments from beauty and personal experience. So there's a wide range of ways of coming to God, and Peter quite nicely summarizes them. So I often encourage people, if you're just going to read one thing, read that. And if you have a son or a daughter or a friend who's drifted into atheism or agnosticism, send them that article. And even better, say, which of these arguments do you think is the strongest? And why do you still not find it persuasive? What's wrong with it? That's a great way to get the conversation going. Probably the second most popular article we have is an article by a Muslim who, I think the article is titled very simply, "I'm a Muslim and Here's Why I Admire the Catholic Church," where he highlights many things that a Muslim or perhaps even an atheist could find compelling about Catholicism. And then finally, the third most popular article is by a young man who was writing under a pseudonym at the time, Steve Gershom, who wrote an article titled "Catholic, Gay, and Feeling Just Fine." And his article was meant to show that somebody with same-sex attractions could still be a faithful and joyous Catholic, that the two aren't incompatible, and that while the church teaches that homosexual activity is intrinsically wrong, having same-sex attractions isn't necessarily so. And so the article, I think, got a lot of traction because for atheists, that was quite surprising. They thought that the church condemned anybody who was attracted to people of the same sex. So it was kind of an eye-opening moment for many of them to think, well, maybe there's something there in the Catholic Church. Maybe they are a bit more compassionate and welcoming than I first thought.
Wow, that's great. Yeah, I highly encourage people to go check that out. We are talking to Brandon Vaught. You've got a lot of actually free stuff that people can get, not just those articles. Tell the people what else they can get at your website, because you're pretty generous with the handing out stuff, Brandon.
Yeah, I try to be. Probably the most downloaded free thing I have is if you go to BrandonVaught.com, you'll see it right at the top. You can't miss it. The latest book I wrote, I'm giving away completely for free. It's called The Saints' Favorite Books. Read what they read, become who they are. And what I did was looked at 14 saints who I've researched over the years for other projects. And while researching them, I was reading their journals, reading their diaries, looking at their writings, and noticed that many of them could point to a particular book that had a profound effect on their lives, that set their lives in a new direction. So I pulled these together and said, for these 14 saints, which book had the greatest impact on them? Because I want to read that book. If I want to be like them, I want to read the same books that they read.
Right.
So the Saints' Favorite Books you can download. So go to BrandonVaught.com and get that book for free, The Saints' Favorite Books.
That's fantastic. Something else that you're involved in, if you want to put in a little plug, as the content provider for Word on Fire Ministries and Bishop Barron. I know a lot of our SoCal listeners will be interested and maybe are new to him. What does he have coming out? What do you have coming out at Word on Fire that we should be looking for?
Yeah, we have so many projects. The best place to go to get a grasp on everything Bishop Barron's working on is his website, which is wordonfire.org. And every week we have a new homily, which is an audio of his homily for the upcoming Sunday. He has a new article each week where he comments on some instance of popular culture. And then just about every week we have a new YouTube video where, again, he comments on some instance of popular culture. But in terms of our bigger projects, we just released an exciting new study program called Mystery of God, which you can find at mysteryofgod.com. And it includes 6 talks from Bishop Barron, really on many of the issues we've just been discussing. So how do we know God exists? What is he like? How do we know God is loving? A lot of these central questions that not just atheists and agnostics are wondering about, but even many Catholics. So if you want a great DVD and study program, maybe for your small group or parish, then check out mysteryofgod.com. Then finally, the big project we're working on is going to be called Catholicism, the Pivotal Players. And Bishop Barron has traveled the world looking at 12 key figures who have not only shaped the church, but changed the course of Western civilization. And they include Thomas Aquinas, Catherine Siena, St. Francis of Assisi, Michelangelo, G.K. Chesterton, and John Henry Newman. So a very wide and varied group of people, but it's going to be a hugely beneficial thing, not just to the church, but to people outside the church.
Yeah, that sounds absolutely fantastic. I'm excited about that. I can't wait to see that. Brandon Vaught, it is always a pleasure to talk to you. For our audience, please go to BrandonVaught.com to find out more about Brandon. Brandon, thanks for being on the show today.
Thank you, Don. You're so great. Thank you.
And we will be right back after this bottom of the hour break on the Immaculate Heart Radio Network. This is the Don Johnson Show. Stick around. Hey everyone, welcome back to the Don Johnson Show. Great to have you along on Immaculate Heart Radio this morning. We are broadcasting from Christ Cathedral Campus in beautiful Orange County, California. I want to start this segment with a story that I saw on thestream.org, but actually comes out of Britain. Here's the headline. Scientists claim zapping brains with magnets can treat belief in God. William M. Briggs is the author of the piece, and he talks about how scientists in England have tried to get people to abandon their belief in God by attaching magnets to their brain. Here's how it's done. Using a technique called transcranial magnetic stimulation, researchers now can, quote, safely shut down certain groups of neurons, close quote, in the brain. The news report is based on a paper called Neuromodulation of Group Prejudice and Religious Belief by Colin Holbrook and four others in the journal Social, Cognitive, and Affective Neuroscience. Not something I have subscribed to, I'm afraid. But anyway, this paper is one of a long line of studies that purports to explain the workings of the human mind and uses things like questionnaires and magnets to figure out people's belief systems and then ultimately change them, it seems. Now, there's a lot we could talk about with this story. I just want to briefly address the worldview that is underlying a lot of this kind of research and the stories. The idea is this, that everything in reality is only matter, is only stuff, that matter is all there is. There is no other dimension to life. That we are made up of small particles, smaller and smaller as we continue to research, but that we're made up of small particles and that everything in the universe can be explained materially. And the idea is that everything in reality can be explained materially. That is, if we examine it under a strong enough microscope and with the proper conditions, we know everything that goes on. We can observe it. We can touch it, feel it, see it, this sort of thing. Now, this is called naturalism or materialism, that worldview. And it's very reductionistic. By that, I mean it reduces everything that we normally think of in our day-to-day lives. Things like love, courage, free will, the stuff that is quite important in everyday existence, belief in God, it reduces all of those things to physics, ultimately. And so they try to examine it within that framework. Now, there's many ways that the naturalistic, materialistic understanding of reality breaks down. And I just want to point out one. There's many we could talk about. I'm just going to point out one. It is self-refuting. By that, I mean the materialistic understanding of reality can't be accepted even on its face. It cuts off the branch that it's standing on. Here's what I mean by that. According to a materialistic understanding of reality, everything exists in a closed system of cause and effect. Reality is a giant machine where things are banging against each other, producing other effects. Now, according to this worldview, all the ideas that we hold, all of the thoughts that we have, are simply material. They are the result of neurons firing and other processes within our brain and within our body and within our culture that cause us to think a certain way. And that thinking itself is just a physical process. That there's nothing spiritual about it. There's nothing immaterial about it. And therefore, if we can change the physical elements that go into your thinking, we can change the way you think. So your beliefs are just one more physical aspect of you, sort of like your skin color or hair color. Now, these scientists think that they can change that. They don't like the way you think, therefore we're going to change that, and so they're going to introduce other physical things, magnetic waves, into the equation and change your ideas. Your ideas, because they are only the result of physical processes in your environment and in your body, they are not to be trusted. Just because you believe in God does not mean that God exists. That's just a physical manifestation of something, and it's not something we like as scientists, and so therefore we're going to try to change it, you see. Your beliefs are not to be trusted. Your beliefs have nothing to do with what's true because they're just a physical part of you. They don't correspond to anything out in reality. And in fact, if within that worldview, if that was the case, if everything was material, if everything was physical, then ideas would be untrustworthy. If everything we thought was just the result of physical processes, then of course we could not trust them. It may be the result of the breakfast I had this morning, and now I believe that I'm Superman or something. And we know this. If we have beliefs that are clearly physically caused, we get too drunk or whatever, those ideas are not to be trusted. But here's the thing. Within that worldview, all ideas would fall under that umbrella, that all ideas, whether it's belief in God or the belief that everything is physical, all ideas would be subject to doubt because they would all be the result of physical processes. We could never really know for certain that everything was the result of physical processes, because it would all be the result of physical processes. And so these scientists are a little bit too unself-reflective, I would say. They're not examining their own worldview and applying it to themselves. Could we, for example, take a magnet and put it on the scientist's head to try to get rid of the belief that matter is all there is, and that ideas are just physical manifestations of certain processes in their brain? Should we not treat that idea in the same way that they treat the idea of God? So the worldview itself is self-refuting. That is, the worldview itself, if it was true, there would be no way that we should believe it. And of course, I don't think it's true, and there's many other reasons to not believe that matter is all there is, not the least of which is miracles, which is the topic I actually want to turn to next in the few minutes we have left here in the show. So as I was traveling around filming the documentary Convinced, which is currently available at convincedmovie.com and various other outlets, I talked to a lot of converts, people who were atheists, agnostics, former other religions, former different varieties of Christian, and they all became Catholic. And one of the reasons that they did is that they saw God do miraculous things in their life. For example, Devin Rose, who is an author based out of Texas, he struggled with depression, and nothing would solve his depression. He was to the point of being suicidal. And at one point, he decided, he was an atheist, and at one point he decided, I'm going to try something else. The atheism isn't working. I'm going to call out to God. I'm going to pray. I'm going to see what happens. And what happened was his depression lifted, that the only thing that helped him was prayer. And so he thought, looking at the evidence, if the only thing that has worked so far is prayer, I'm going to keep doing that. I'm going to see where this leads. I'm going to follow after God. And so this, what he considered at the time, potentially a miraculous sign, he followed that evidence where it led, and it led him to the church, ultimately. But it's not the only miracle. There was all sorts of miracles. People have all kinds of experiences. A couple of people in the movie, I'm not going to give away the whole storyline, but they hesitantly asked Mary to intercede for them in a couple of different ways, and they saw miraculous signs that convinced them that indeed Mary was interceding for them and God was powerfully at work in the world today. And there's innumerable other examples out there in the culture. In fact, as I was doing research for a book I wrote a couple years ago called How to Talk to a Skeptic, I researched the evidence of miracles, and I just want to share a few stories that I came across from a variety of types of people, including many college professors. For instance, J.P. Moreland, he shares this story. He was speaking at a large church about how to nurture God confidence in people when the following episode took place. He says, "As we were taking a coffee break, a young man on the church staff approached me rather sheepishly and began to share something from his own journey. This young man was in a machine shop when heavy machinery fell on him and fractured his chest and hands. He was rushed to the doctor, x-rayed, and sent home that evening with pain medication. He was scheduled to come back the next morning for further examination and treatment. That evening, some Christian friends came to his house and prayed for his healing. Even though he was on pain medication, he could still feel pain. However, as the people prayed, the pain vanished and the swelling in his hands left. He was startled. The next morning, the surgeons took new x-rays, which indicated that the fractures were completely healed. The doctor also noted that the swelling was gone, something that just does not happen so quickly on its own. When the doctors compared the two sets of x-rays, it was clear that he had been miraculously healed. The fractures were gone." That is a quite typical story. Here's another one. This one comes from a man I actually talked to and verified. His name is Jason, and he was attending seminary, doing some doctoral studies, but he didn't have enough money to continue. And so he prayed and asked God to provide the amount of his tuition bill. It was $2,117.60. Now, just a few days after that prayer, Heather, his wife, was looking through some letters that her senile grandmother had written to her, but never mailed. She was up in the attic cleaning out some stuff. She was rummaging through some piles of old correspondence. To her amazement, included in the many letters with expressions of love for her were a number of bank bonds. And so they gathered all the bonds together, and after they had been tallied, they totaled $2,000. Now, here's the real crazy part. That's cool, but here's the crazy part. When they deposited the bonds in the bank the next day, the bank receipt reported the figure of $2,117.60. The bonds had appreciated and now were the exact amount that Jason and Heather needed to continue to pay their tuition. And that's the kind of thing God does. He takes care of us, miracle provision. He heals. He guides our life in a particular way. But for some reason, people don't like to share this stuff very much. And after we come back from the break, I want to talk a little bit about that. What are some of the reasons that we don't share our miracle stories as confidently as we should? And what can we do to be better about it? You're listening to the Don Johnson Radio Show on Immaculate Heart Radio. We will be right back after this break.
Coming soon, it's the Saints and Sinners Tour with Matt Maher. Matt Maher, five-time Grammy nominee and Dove and Unity Award-winning artist, live in concert. Bring the whole family for a night of music, worship, and celebration with Matt Maher. The Saints and Sinners Tour.
Come see Matt at Christ Cathedral Garden Grove, Saturday, January 23rd at 8 p.m. Get tickets at transparentproductions.com.
Hey, everybody, welcome back to the Don Johnson Show. Great to have you along on Immaculate Heart Radio. We've been talking a little bit in this half hour about miracles and the role they play in bringing people to the faith. But interestingly, I have found that although personal experience of the divine in the form of God's providence, God's miraculous provision, healing, although that plays a major part in giving people confidence of their own relationship with Jesus, and if you ask them why they believe, that's often what's really grounding it. When it comes to sharing that with others, we're often very hesitant. We don't normally share those kind of stories. In fact, let me give you an example. I shared the story in the last segment about a young man who had been healed after a large piece of machinery had fallen on him and fractured his chest and hands. He was rushed to the doctor, x-rayed, it was confirmed he had fractures, he was supposed to go back the next morning. They prayed for him that night, and he was healed. They re-x-rayed him in the next morning, and there was nothing wrong with him. Now, that story was shared by J.P. Moreland, who is a professor, travels around a lot, and interestingly, what J.P. Moreland found is that that guy had never ever shared that story with anyone before he shared it with Dr. Moreland. He responded, Moreland says, that he kept the story to himself because he didn't want to talk about himself or appear weird to people. I just want to talk for a moment about that reason, about those reasons, and maybe some other reasons why we wouldn't share our miracle stories with others, and perhaps why those reasons aren't as strong as we think they are and why we should be sharing them. Let's talk about, he says he didn't want to talk about himself. Humility. We want to be humble. We don't want to talk about the things that God has done for us. And I get that. I mean, we don't want to gloat over a miraculous healing, and that's the right attitude. Of course, we're not supposed to glory in ourselves or in our own righteousness. But a healing is hardly something that you can take credit for, is it? I mean, you did not heal yourself. This young man did not heal himself. If he was going to tell that story, it's pretty hard to see how God would not get the credit for the healing. There's nothing the guy did beyond praying that helped his healing. And so I think it's a bit of false humility to say that, oh, I don't want to talk about myself. No, you'd be talking about God. You want to celebrate what God has done. And indeed, that's what God wants us to do. We should celebrate what God has done and share it with others. And celebrating God's actions in the Bible, that's just a huge part of what God wants his people to do. It's an important spiritual discipline, even. It helps foster greater trust in him. God filled the Israelite calendar with festivals and feasts for that very reason, to celebrate the acts of God in their lives and to proclaim them to others. It's also a big part of preaching. I mean, I think of Peter's first evangelistic sermon in the midst of an outpouring of supernatural signs there in Acts chapter 2. He says, "Fellow Israelites, listen to this. Jesus of Nazareth was a man accredited to you by miracles, wonders, and signs, which God did among you, as you yourselves know." right? Again, and Paul, he consistently shared the story of his vision on the road to Damascus and his miraculous conversion. And so sharing these stories is a big part of what people did in the Bible, and I think being humble about it really is a bit of a cop-out, if you will. Well, what about the weirdness factor? The young man said, I don't want to appear weird to others. And, well, I'm not exactly sure what he was thinking about not wanting to appear weird to others. But I suppose he probably didn't want to be associated with those charlatans. I mean, we know those guys on TV with the fake healing and all they want is money, and the televangelists who turn everybody off with their fraudulent claims and all that. I mean, I get that. But the fact that counterfeits exist does not mean that the real thing doesn't. Right? Just because there are false claims of miracles does not mean that we should be quiet about the real claims of miracles. Okay? We can't be quiet just because people lie doesn't mean that we can't tell the truth. Now, here's another one. I think we often play by the skeptics' rules. The desire to not appear weird in our culture may be a sign of something more problematic, I think. And that's an implicit acceptance of many of our society's sort of secularist and naturalistic assumptions about life. We've adopted certain elements of an anti-supernatural bias, I think, unwittingly perhaps, and that we sometimes act as if, well, we don't bring the supernatural stuff into the public realm. We just keep it quiet. We don't talk about it out in the open. That's not really something for public discourse or sharing with our friends. But this is a false notion as well. Refusing to offer spiritual experiences as evidence of what God has done is to deny a big part of reality. And we're essentially letting skeptics have the public domain, have the public arena, without bringing in a whole dimension of reality. And we just can't do that. Now, what about this? I think there is an idea also that miracle stories are inherently unreliable, that they're subjective, that we don't share our spiritual experiences because people don't trust our personal experiences anyway. You know, they seem to think, well, it's just my word, and what good is that? I mean, who's going to believe me anyway? Well, if you're an honest person, your word is plenty good. And the fact is, unless there's some valid reasons not to, we accept personal testimonies all the time. I mean, we typically assume people are not lying to us, right? We typically assume people are not deceived about what they're telling us. I mean, they may not be telling us the truth about anything in reality. But the burden of proof is on establishing guilt, not innocence. We don't assume first that you must be lying to me when you come and tell me a story about your life. We assume you're telling the truth unless there's good reasons not to accept it. And why wouldn't we do that with miracle stories as well? Now, of course, some stories are better supported than others and therefore more believable. I get that. But if we're telling stories about our own life and you're a stable, reliable, informed person, there's no reason not to believe you. You don't have a reason to lie or exaggerate. Unless a person thinks you have some reason to lie or exaggerate, which you don't, why not tell the story? Now, there's going to be a few objections to this, I understand, and I talk more about this in my book, How to Talk to a Skeptic. But let me address one objection that you're likely to get if you do start sharing miracle stories that have happened in your life. And that's going to be some variation of the problem of evil. So, chances are, if the young man I talked about who was cured after having his hands and chest crushed, often people are going to say to that, if God healed you, why wouldn't he heal this person over here? I can't accept that God would do that for you and not for this person or not for that person. And they're going to say something like this. If God can protect and provide food and direct history for good, why do people die of cancer? Why do thousands of children starve to death? If some people get healed, why doesn't everybody get healed? And listen, these are emotionally charged and serious questions, and you can't ignore them. However, I do want to point out that this is a bit of a misdirection. I mean, obviously you have to, if the person is coming from a place where they've experienced a lot of pain and heartache, you can't downplay that. These are serious questions. The problem of evil is perhaps the most serious of the objections to God. And maybe we'll talk a little bit more about it on another day. But for now, let me just point out that the problem of evil does not actually directly apply to a specific miracle story. To illustrate what I mean, let me put it this way. Let's imagine we're first century fishermen living by the Sea of Galilee. right? One day, after tying up our boats, we run into an excited group of people who claim to have been miraculously fed by a guy named Jesus. Hey, he turned 5 loaves and 2 small fishes into a feast for 5,000 people, they exclaim as they rush around the lake in search of another free meal, right? Then we meet a couple of his disciples who claim that he calmed a storm and kept them from drowning. And you say to me, well, hey, that's interesting. I mean, I wonder if those stories are true. Maybe we should go check that out. But I am not interested. No. If there's a miracle worker in the region, hey, why didn't we get any food? And why didn't this Jesus show up and save my uncle from drowning in this godforsaken lake last month? I mean, these stories are clearly false. I don't even think this guy exists. That could be my response. But I hope you can see the logical fallacy here. It does not follow that just because Jesus didn't show up to heal my uncle or to provide me a miraculous catch of fish or a special abundance of food for my family does not mean that he didn't do it somewhere else. Jesus could protect and provide food for some people and not others. There's no law of the universe that says if some people are protected and fed, then everybody must be. And so it's perfectly reasonable, should the evidence support it, to believe that Jesus exists and did a miracle for some people and not for others. And in the same way, it's reasonable to accept that God exists and is active in the world while accepting that he doesn't always perform miracles on behalf of everyone. And so the problem of evil actually has no bearing on whether or not God exists or whether he interacts with his creation in certain acts of personal providence, right? Just because a miracle did not happen over here does not mean A, that there is no God, or B, that another miracle didn't happen over here. And so if you've experienced miracles, if you've had God work in your life in an extraordinary way, you don't need to be shy about these things. I would encourage you to share them with others. Well, if you want to hear more miracle stories, I encourage you to check out the movie Convinced. You can find that at convincedmovie.com. And if you want to read more about some of the stories I talked about today, you can find that in How to Talk to a Skeptic, a book I published a few years back. You can learn more about me and The Don Johnson Show at donjohnsonministries.org. Thank you for joining me here on the Immaculate Heart Radio Network. We'll be back broadcasting from the Tower of Hope at Christ Cathedral next Friday, and I hope you'll join us then.